We're very happy that Brian is joining us here today to talk about his work and talk about the upcoming tours that are that he'll be holding down there, as well as some of his discoveries. So let's welcome Brian Forrester to the show. Welcome, Brian. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Like I had said, the way I discovered you was from all of your videos that you post, pretty much. Is it fair to say that, and I guess this is just a personal question before we get into a little bit more history, do you post videos pretty much every other day? Or are you always out there in the field filming your work and recording it?
Oh, very much so. And actually, the last two that I posted, one was last night and one was this morning, are the most mind-blowing experiences.
Yeah, I saw that.
Oh, you did? Yeah, no, I always carry my cameras with me. We found what is an elongated skull of a baby on the coast of Peru here, and it's I've been working with Lloyd Pye, who some of you may know of from the Star Child Project, and this is just, this is amazing. It could be a sub-race of human being that we've discovered.
Wow.
Wow.
That is mind-blowing, fascinating. Wow. Let's go ahead and get started with, letting our audience get to know you a little bit, Brian. We have information on a little bit about your background, but why don't you tell us in your own words what brought you into the work that you're doing today, basically? What got you into it? What got you interested in doing it? And what made it become your passion?
Well, it basically started in quite early childhood. I grew up on the west coast of Canada, so I became fascinated by the native people of the area because as a young person, I began to ask, who am I, where do I live, and who would know about this area? And immediately I thought, well, I'm of European background, and so my people have only been here for maybe 100 years. The native people have been here for at least 10,000, so they would be the ones to ask. So I started carving as a child. That became my full-time profession after university. I got a degree in biology but chose to pursue sculpture. So I've carved totem poles and canoes and things like that in the native tradition. And after that, I became fascinated by another childhood love, and that was Hawaii. So I moved to Hawaii and assisted in the construction of a 62-foot voyaging canoe destined to go to Tahiti. And that continued. My Polynesian fascination continued on for quite a long time. But then, for some reason, Peru started to enter my consciousness. And so I came here 5 years ago. And it's been very difficult to leave. I now live here. I've chosen, my last trip from Canada was a one-way ticket. So I've chosen to live here, and I'm very much embraced by the people, the culture, and the ancestors.
Oh, how wonderful. Lucky you. I'm sure Yvonne is a little jealous.
Well, I'm waiting for my children to grow up, and then I'll be joining you.
Lovely.
So as you started your work in Peru, Brian, what was one of the first things that you discovered that really piqued your interest and really held your attention?
Well, the first of any culture that one would look at, the Inca, of course, would be number one. And so that was my interest. And I visited Cusco many times with my wife, who is Peruvian. And quite rapidly, I found that a number of the tour guides didn't seem to have as much information as I thought they would about the history of the Inca people. It was mainly textbook, Western slanted information, and not enough from the indigenous side. So gradually I began to gather information from the early Spanish chronicles and from native people I know. And my wife was instrumental in telling me, well, if you can't find the book or the right book, write the book. So my first book, A Brief History of the Incas, is just that. And that's, I've now written seven related books. But the Inca history is incredibly fascinating because the aspects written that are basically written about are a very small part of the entire story.
I would figure that. Unfortunately, we know that much of the Western history is, well, it's tainted by, I guess, whether it be the time of the Spanish conquistadors, which is slanted by the church and whatnot, and the empirical thinking. But can you tell us a little bit about the Inca? What can you share with us today about their culture that we just aren't learning in the history books? What type of a culture was it? Was it a mass group of people? Was it just a specific race? Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Oh, sure. Well, what's generally believed is that the Inca began as a people around Tiwanaku, which is near Lake Titicaca. And it was because there was a 40-year drought about the year 900 AD that they were forced to leave. They couldn't grow food anymore, and so the standard story is that they moved northwards and found the Sacred Valley, which is near Cusco, and then they founded the city of Cusco. People were already living there, but under very primitive conditions, so the Inca were very highly evolved, especially in ways of agriculture, and so they immediately taught the local people how to grow, you know, grow food. They were master engineers. And so that's the standard story, that they arrived in Cusco about the year 1200 AD, and they were more or less destroyed by the Spanish by 1533. But the real story is that it's more probable that Cusco was a thriving ancient megalithic city about 10 to 12,000 years ago, and the Inca simply moved into Cusco. They found buildings there that were, you know, stone buildings. They adopted those buildings, and then they built the city around them. So that's where I'm researching the mystery of the megaliths. I'm 100% positive that the Inca did not build the megalithic buildings.
Wow. It's very it parallels the story of the ancient Egyptians and how it's believed, how some alternative researchers believe very similar story. Is that right?
Exactly. It's exactly the same story. The pharaonic period of Egypt, you know, covers possibly, you know, from the year 3000 BC. But people like Chris Dunn, who's a friend of mine, who wrote the Giza Power Plant, Stephen Mailer, who is a major researcher and also an expert on crystal skulls and is a student of oral traditions, they know for sure that the Great Pyramids, for example, and the Sphinx are at least 10 to 12,000 years old. The pharaonic Egyptians moved into that area, adopted the structures, but did not build them.
Wow. It opens up a whole can of worms for me as far as, like, thinking of the timeline that we've been taught, and not only that, and not to take away too much attention from the Americas, but it makes me wonder about the Dogon, if they were the ancestors of the pharaonic Egyptians or of the earlier culture, and that should have been a question that we asked. what are your thoughts? Do you know much about the tribes that left Egypt? As far as, like,
yeah,
the Dogon are concerned, were they pharaonic or were they prehistory?
No, I think that's an excellent question, and I really suggest that you get Stephen Mailer on sometime, because he is an expert of ancient Egyptian oral tradition. His teacher was a man called Hakim, who was shown on the Pyramid Code series. Just a brilliant man, very quiet, you know, like most oral tradition people, native people, you know, around the world tend to be very quiet people, but they are the living libraries, and it's through him that Stephen learned a lot of information. The Dogon seem to be an offshoot people of the very, very early Egyptian Kemetian race, possibly, that were there before the pharaonic people arrived. And there are many, many others. There's also a race of elongated people who lived in Sudan, and they emigrated to the Congo. And they have these elongated heads, which are very similar to what the people such as Akhenaten and Tutankhamun may have had, the Amarna period.
Mm. Very interesting because for me it's interesting because as someone who is very excited by ancient history and whatnot, we see all these modern documentaries of how they force the skulls to be elongated or something. At least that was one theory that I know I probably saw on some corporate cable channel or something. But I know that you have been finding a lot of these elongated skulls in Peru. And what has been your discoveries as far as these skulls? Were these molded, like, at birth when their head was soft, or was this actually a race of people with elongated skulls in your finding?
Well, the amazing thing is that there seem to be two types. David Hatcher Childress and I are writing a book right now about the global phenomenon of the elongated skull, because it happened in Egypt during the Amarna period, we presume. It also happened in Malta, in Russia, in Europe, in Melanesia, the Olmecs of Mexico, and also in Peru, exactly where I am. The funny thing is that I'm at the epicenter of the elongated skull culture here. It's quite possible that the Inca were the last of the descendants, but we seem to have found two kinds. We found those that have been elongated by cranial manipulation using ropes or cords, but we're also finding examples where they may genetically be naturally elongated. I found six different characteristics which appear to be non-conventional human.
Wow.
And when you say non-conventional human, do you mean something in the sense that it's not in the timeline as far as, like, quote unquote evolution, and is it possibly otherworldly, or is that taking it too far?
It's possible that there is genetic input from off planet, but we don't know. Lloyd Pye has some DNA samples that I sent him, hair, skin, bone, and teeth, which his geneticists are going to analyze soon. But so I don't really like to speculate.
Right.
But what we seem to see happening is that a seafaring people arrived here several thousand years ago from somewhere, and over time they bred with other, you know, quote unquote normal people, and so the elongation started to disappear. And what happened after that was that there was a desperate attempt to bring these ancestral features back because of their high level of intelligence, and that's when the binding began.
Mm.
Oh, so it was kind of like they were trying to emulate them. Is that what you're getting from their culture?
Exactly. Well, that's if you ask any of the cultures around the world why, you know, why did they bind their children's skulls? It was only the royalty and the high priestly class, which were usually the same family, that this was done to. And the story seems to be generally the same thing, and that is that they wished to emulate the ancestors because the ancestors had a very high level of intelligence. And also it was thought to be a beautiful, a thing of beauty as well.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that answers a question that Annie mentioned she wanted to
yeah,
ask.
Yeah, question on the chat. Wonderful. Well, I'm glad we answered that. But let me take it a step further and ask you, Brian, has there been much, I don't know how to phrase this question correctly, but has there been much evidence that you have found to be, analyzed to be true as far as a culture being there before the Inca? Are these skulls that culture, or are these the Inca that were just starting to mix with the culture, the native people?
Well, there's a very distinct Paracas culture, and, general archaeology is describing them as being, as being quite primitive people who lived on the coast. But there are some, the more that I, more time I spend here, the more fascinating they become, because they have or had the largest elongated skulls in the world. There are examples in the local Ica Museum where it seems that their cranial capacity was almost twice as much of an average human. It's not simply that the skull was altered in shape, but they're bigger. I mean, these are huge, and those are the ones that are always shown on, you know, ancient alien type shows. It's like, you know, who were these people? The more research I do here, the more complex these people become. They weren't simply, you know, farmers and fishermen. It turns out they were, you know, whale hunters and I found a pyramid that they made out of adobe, and it's just every day is something new. And the one problem I'm having is that I can't find experts who know about it, because no one has studied the Paracas culture since 1928.
Really?
Yeah.
And what happened? Did someone just drop the ball, or were they told not to study it? Or
well, I'm not exactly sure. The man who did was called Julio Teo. He's the most famous archaeologist in the history of Peru, and he was here in 1927. He found the graveyard of the elongated skulled royal family, but then he moved on and started working at other sites, and no one's really picked up his research since then. They have 450 of these skulls and actually intact mummies in a museum in Lima, but they're all stored away. There's almost nothing in Lima on display in the museums in regard to this, and I'm not sure if it's a cover-up or what is happening, but I'm on the front line here.
Well, we're very glad you're there, absolutely.
Thank you.
You brought up mummies, and as far as, you know, the general public is concerned, and I don't know if our listeners are in themselves have researched enough, but our researchers in themselves, I'm sorry. But I personally didn't even know that we had mummies in South America till maybe 5 years ago. First of all, let me ask you about that. Is their mummification technique different than what we're finding in Egypt?
Yeah, it doesn't seem that mummification here was done through artificial means. Because it's such a dry environment, it seems that the bodies were simply buried. They were wrapped in many layers of cotton and then buried in the sand. And the sand is so dry that it naturally desiccates everything. For example, I had two people from Seattle here this morning visiting the Paracas History Museum where I'm at, and Senior Juan, who is the owner, brought out some peanuts, which are peanuts in their shell, and these people looked at that and they went, "Oh, that's nice. They grew peanuts here." And I said, "Yes, but these peanuts are 3,000 years old, and they look like you could have bought them from the store yesterday."
Oh, wow.
The preservation process here is absolutely incredible.
Now, and that's from the climate, you're saying?
Yes.
Oh, okay. And so then, what is the difference? Oh, well, I'm sitting here trying to go through the timeline in my brain. The difference in the climate, was Egypt more moist back then? Is that the difference, maybe?
I think the Egyptians simply had a more complex ceremony involved.
Wow.
You know, they would remove the organs, they would remove the brain, and that sort of thing. The Paracas, as far as I can tell, didn't do that. They simply buried the whole body. But you know, we're still early on in the research with this. The climate here was very different 1,500 years ago. It was much greener than it was. Again, I'm at the early stages of that aspect of it.
Right.
Can I, while we're on climate, Brian, have you been to Pachamama site very much and done anything there? I think it's called Moray. Is it Moray?
Oh, yeah. Moray.
Moray. I've seen a picture of you stood next to it, but that was one of my favorite bits of it.
No, it's an amazing place. It's far more complicated than what people say it is. It's often regarded as being an experimental station that the Inca built, you know, which does make sense. It's a series of concentric circles. It's like it looks like a stadium, and it's monstrous in size.
It takes a long time to walk. Yeah.
Yeah, it's about the size of a, you know, of a football field, except it's a giant circle. It looks like it was naturally a volcanic crater, but the acoustics there are so phenomenal that I think before the Inca existed, it was an auditorium. We were lucky to be there when they were having an Inca ceremony, and the acoustics were amazing.
Wow, I'd love to have seen that. I ran down it right to the bottom, and I didn't realize how far it was and just collapsed at the bottom. But the energy from the bottom of it was just amazing.
Oh, very much so. If you stand in the center, there, you know, it's, you know, the sacred number 7 exists in Inca places a lot, or Inca or older places a lot. And that has a series of 7 concentric circles, and then 7 levels above that. And if you stand in the center of that place, that is an absolute power point.
Yeah.
So, Brian, it's believed that this was an auditorium of sorts, or an amphitheater. Is that what you guys have been finding out?
I think to call it an amphitheater would be a simplistic way to describe it. It was probably a major ceremonial place involving energy. Bottom layer, the bottom circle, being the place where the priestly class would conduct energy ceremonies, and then the upper tiers could very well be where the audience or the other participants would sit. Basically each level is a chakra.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so it's possible that if you sat on a certain level, you'd be working on your heart chakra or one of the others.
I wish I knew that, because the local guide told us that it was an Inca greenhouse. None of the other information.
No, but that's the whole thing is that a lot of the guides don't really learn enough. And so you do have to, ask the what is left of the old tradition people in and around Cusco, what was the function? And over time you get the most amazing stories of, well, 25,000 years ago, people built this. And it's like, well, that's impossible. It's like, no, it was 25,000 years ago. And you say, but native people didn't, cross the land bridge. And the local people would say, they didn't cross the land bridge. These people sailed on ships. It's like, oh, okay. and they had red hair. And it's like, what? It goes on and on like this.
I love hearing this, because I love to hear the discrepancies. Could you share a few more discrepancies with us as far as what the guides offer versus the reality of what the natives are telling us? You said something about red hair. Who would have thought that they had red hair? I guess another one is, did they practice ritual sacrifice in amphitheaters like that?
Well, that's excellent. Thank you for that. Because a lot of the, a lot of the bad information was probably created early on by the Spanish themselves, and more specifically the Catholic Church. Because the best way to control a people is to destroy their belief system. So the first thing the Spanish did when they entered Cusco, which was the capital, was they destroyed the Temple of the Sun. And the Temple of the Sun was the center of worship and philosophy and everything for the Inca people. And they immediately built a giant church on top of that. So what that meant is that the people who used to visit, to visit that place because it was the spiritual center. Now they, again, were entering the spiritual center, but it had a different symbolism. Exactly the same thing that happened in places like Europe. The cathedrals are built on older pagan temples. That's basically what happened. I've lost my train of thought.
That's okay. I'll bring your train of thought back in a second, but I have to say, Yvonne, does it make you feel like you're in Peru again, hearing all that beeping?
It's making me giggle, actually.
Same
here.
I'm out on the veranda enjoying the view.
Well, thank you for the authenticity of the scenery.
It reminds me of them scary buses hanging off cliffs that I went on quite a few times.
Oh, I know. Just make sure your driver hasn't been drinking.
Exactly.
But I guess to get back into your train of thought, tell us about the discrepancies of, let's say, the people. Were they all short little people with little bang haircuts and black hair, or were they tall? And you said something about red hair.
Yeah, no, that's the amazing thing. Well, the thing is, what the church and others would do is they would make stories up. Like they would say, your ancestors sacrificed people to their gods, and therefore, you have to be ashamed of who you are because that, that was a heinous act. And there are very few examples of the Inca having sacrificed people. They have found mummies up on the tops of some of the Andes, usually young children who had been heavily drugged, and they had been given as offerings to the living deities of the mountains themselves. But it wasn't an extensive thing that was done. Also, people, almost every depiction of the Inca is of these warriors. The high Inca is always, carrying a club in his hand. And what I've learned is that the Inca were, the main thing that the Inca were incredible organizers of people. And they never had an empire. They had a confederation. Mm-hmm. So as they expand, and that's why they were so successful, is that as they chose to expand north and south and east and west, they would first go to the people, the high people of the bordering state, and say, we would like you to join our confederation. We have all of these things that we can offer you. We have, incredible farming techniques. We have incredible engineering knowledge, et cetera. Would you like to join us? And if the, if the chief said, no, we don't want to, then the Inca would withdraw and come back and say, we wish you to reconsider, joining us, because we have this road system, we have this and we have that. And by the way, we have an army of 100,000 warriors. And then if the chief said no, then they would withdraw and come back again with gifts and say, we would like you to join us, and if you don't, we have an army.
Oh.
So if, at that point, if the absorption or the addition was not made, then the Inca would go to war with them, but they would stop as soon as their, quote-unquote opponent gave in. They would immediately stop all warfare and say, okay, that's fine. You are now part of our system, and all wrongdoings from the past that you have done in terms of killing some of our people are forgiven, and we are all, part of the same people now.
Very different from today's world.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But in terms of physical characteristics, yeah, the Inca were very different. The average Peruvian here is, very dark-skinned, black, they're native people,
right.
Black hair, generally quite short in height. But when the Spanish encountered... Yeah, oh, yeah, oh, definitely. But when the Spanish encountered the Inca, though, they were of the same, at least the same height as the Spanish were. It's also remarked that they had quite light-colored skin, and some of them had red hair. Some even had blonde hair. And there's even suggestion that they had elongated skulls. Not huge, but, their skulls were slightly different. Very beautiful-looking people. I've only met two Inca, true Inca descendants, and they do not look like they're, they don't look like the average South American person. They look more like they're Basque or something like that.
Wow.
I met one on the plane from Brazil to Lima, and he hardly spoke any English, but through sign language, I was telling him what we were doing, more or less. And he looked more Egyptian.
Oh.
It's just a memory that came back to me then. He said he was a true, his ancestors were true Incas.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the tour guides in Cusco will say the same thing, and it's not true. The majority of the high Inca were murdered by this one half Inca just before the arrival of the Spanish. There was a civil war that went on just before the Spanish arrived, and that's why the Spanish were able to conquer. So the half Inca called Atahualpa was given half, or not even half, he was given the northern section of Inca land, but he decided that he wanted all of it, and he sent his army to Cusco, and they slaughtered 90% of the royal family.
Wow.
of the Inca. And so anyone, you know, today will say, you know, I'm descended from the Incas. It's not true. As I said, I've met two, and they did not look, you know, they didn't look like the average Peruvian. Very, like, very regal people. They, you know, they have this real, if you've ever been near people who are of royal blood, like I've met in Hawaii and places where they speak of people having mana, which is this life force. These two ladies had that. They were just like, whoa, you know, I get, you know, chicken skin is also what the Hawaiians say. It's like, you know, you get really
goosebumps,
yeah, when you're with these people because, they are different.
And now, is this because their lineage dates back to the pre-Incan or because of the bloodline of the Incan?
It's from the earliest bloodlines, and the actual origins are unknown. Tiwanaku, which is where they're from, could very well be 15,000 years old. That's, you know, some of the work that people like Graham Hancock, who I do, I write articles for Graham. You know, that's part of the theory is that Tiwanaku and Pumapunku are so ancient. A lot of archaeologists don't even want to go to, you know, don't want to talk about them because they don't fit the timeline.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you want to get into it, we, you know, we could be talking about a quote-unquote Atlantean race that, you know, they're the last of their survivors may have come to South America and could very well have been the ancestors of the ancient Inca.
Oh, wow.
I find that very fascinating because that happens. That's kind of like one of my theories of how the Egyptian and I would guess the early Americas were of the Atlanteans spreading out, and maybe that's how they got the technologies. And with that, Brian, could you share with us a little bit as far as some of the technologies that these people had that were either being ignored by modern archaeology and the media, of course, that just does not seem to fit the timeline. What are some of this technology that you're finding at these sites, far as maybe stonemasonry and things like that, that just don't fit the paradigm of the modern archaeology timeline?
Well, that's where it's a lot of fun, and that's where I love the fact that you know, Chris Dunn is a friend of mine, and Stephen Mailer and others, because there are amazing parallels between both Peru and ancient, you know, pre-Pharaonic Egypt. The prevailing theory that's going on now is that whoever these ancient people were, they had the ability to use sound in a way that we still can't. They were able to somehow use ultrasonic vibration to be able to cut stone and move it, not levitating stone, but neutralizing gravity so that 40-ton blocks, you know, could almost float across the ground kind of thing. Yeah, I know it sounds weird, but, you know, that's where we seem to be headed.
I've heard that before as well.
Yeah, well, the wonderful thing is that when you have someone who's pragmatic like Christopher Dunn, who's, you know, who's an engineer, you know, he has been to Pumapunku, and he has told me, he said that, you know, they must have had ultrasonic tools to be able to cut, you know, stone like this. Some people talk about lasers, but Chris is also an expert at working with industrial lasers, and he said light can't do that. Light can't cut stone. Sound can. So that's, we're again at the early stages of that. We can't find any of the tools here in Peru, but there are a number of components of tools that have been found in Egypt, presently in the Cairo Museum, but they've been mislabeled. There are these circular things made out of amazing hard stone, which are labeled as being ceremonial plates, but according to Stephen Mailer and others, what they were is they were these discs that spun at incredibly high velocity, and they were part of this ultrasonic machine. That's about as far as I've been able to get into it so far.
Oh, wow. You know, and we're finding so much, I guess, well, we're seeing so much recently as a general public as far as what sound can do. I think I recently saw... And I hate to sound like a Facebook addict, but I recently saw something on Facebook where there was a video of something where they were, I guess it was like a tray of sand, and they did a specific tone or specific sound, and the sand creates these particular patterns. And so if we have that now, I can only imagine it's people that have really studied it and fine-tuned it really could probably do a lot with a culture with that.
Well, exactly, and according to Inca traditions, what they say, you know, the thing about oral traditions which people really should take into account is that they are poetry. They are not. It's rarely is it ever straight text. It's always written in a poetic way so that it makes it more listenable. So one example of that is where they say that the Inca rose from the waters of Lake Titicaca. It doesn't mean that the people literally came out of the water. It means that they came from, you know, they came from the Lake Titicaca area. And the same analogy can be given in terms of continents sinking. It isn't necessarily that an ancient continent physically sunk, but at the end of the Ice Age, you know, 12,000 years ago to 9,000 years ago, what happened is that the polar caps melted and the oceans of the world rose by at least 350 feet. And so in a poetic way, what you would say is the land, you know, the land sank. But what in fact what happened is the water rose. But to make it sound cool, you do it as poetry that way. And so in terms of the Inca, what they say is that the high priest would chant, and by chanting, the stones would fly.
Wow.
So again, that may be a poetic way of saying, rather than saying, the ancient ones had this machine that did this, it's like, you know, it's an interpretation of that.
A romantic.
Exactly.
Romantic, yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brian, and I know that you're in Peru and you've studied you're studying the Inca and the sites around Peru, but for the layperson that isn't an archaeologist or an alternative archaeologist like yourself, we're basically indoctrinated into when we learn about the Americas, about learning about the Aztecs, the Inca, and maybe they mention the Mayans. Can you explain, at least I know this is like very basic, but can you tell us the regions and maybe the times of these different tribes? Because a lot of people get them very confused, and I used to be one of those people, so I'm hoping we'll be able to help some people out there by explaining this. The Aztecs are Mexican, and the Mayans were South Mexico. Is that about right, or can you elaborate?
Yeah, actually, that's a really good question because, you know, some people say, well, the Aztecs, when they built Cusco, and it's like, what?
Right, exactly.
You know, and it's, you know, it's very important. I'm actually, I'm reading right now about Cortez and how he conquered the Aztec, but basically the Aztec center is what is now Mexico City. And at the time of the Aztecs, which is about, you know, in the years 1400s, they arrived from elsewhere, and they built their, you know, their capital on an island in the middle of the lake, and over time expanded it. So the center of Aztec activity was Mexico. What is Mexico City? The lake has been filled in, and now it's, you know, a city of 20 million or something. But the Aztecs were also very short-lived. They were, you know, a ballpark figure is, say, 1400 to 1500 and something is when they basically existed. The Mayan are farther south. They're an older culture. And I think it's important to mention the Mayan calendar because a lot of evidence states or is seeming to prove that the Maya did not make the calendar. The calendar's older. It was made by probably the Olmec culture, who were a much older culture, and they had elongated heads, but that's another topic. But the Olmec disappeared, and they the calendar and things like that were inherited by the Maya. And another important thing for people also to know is that very few people consult the Maya elders as to what 2012 means. There's been a lot of hype and a lot of paranoia about that, that it's the end of the world. But if you talk to a traditional Maya elder, they will say it is the end of a world. That means the end of an age. And so that's very different from our perspective. Our perspective is, oh my God, it's the end of the world. And it's like, no, it's not. It's actually, we're moving into a beautiful time period, not a time of awful destruction, but people rarely consult the Mayan people.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think that's important. And in terms of the Inca began about the year 1200 AD, and they disappeared more or less about 1533. And the Inca were not the only important civilization. They were more or less the peak of the pyramid of all the cultures that came before the Inca were cultures that the Inca learned from, and the Inca adopted and adapted the brilliance of the older cultures, and that's why they became so famous, is that they, you know, they were students of several thousand years of native history.
Mm. Oh, I like that.
Fascinating, because you know, again, we get so much information that people really don't, I guess, go into detail and try to put the picture together. I know for myself, for quite a long time, I mixed the Aztec and the Mayan for many, many years, and until, you know, maybe 10 years ago when I started doing this work. But I find that there's just so much confusion as far as who they were, what they did, who fought with who, you know, who really did do blood sacrifice, who, and just you stating the fact of the Olmec and the Mayan calendar is really a wonderful addition to my personal research, because now I'm probably going to have to go down that rabbit hole and see what's going on with that. But it's true, though. I really appreciate you sharing that insight as far as the Mayan calendar, because, like you said, unfortunately, most people turn to, you know, Netflix for their information for for 2012 versus really consulting the people who know this information or have studied it or scholars on it or were a part of the culture that created it. And moving on to another topic, we are here, I guess, in Western culture here in North America, and I'm sure in Europe, when we talk about Peru, we usually only hear about Machu Picchu. We don't really hear anything else except for Machu Picchu. We might hear the Inca and might hear a little bit about other sites, but if I'm not mistaken, you have seen many, many, many sites and have participated in work in some of them. Could you share some of the sites that you've been to and maybe tell some of the more fascinating features that you have seen or come across?
Sure. No, that's a very good point, because Machu Picchu is beautiful. And it's, you know, it is the most amazing place. You can't take pictures that can do justice. You have to be there.
No.
And it's part of it is the energetics. There's a very heavy layer of serpentine stone underneath it, and
wow.
That and serpentine has this inherent quality of calming people down. So anyone who goes, and it's energizing. So, you know, anyone who goes there goes into this, you know, mild hypnotic state, I would call it. But the thing about Machu Picchu, again, is, you know, the conventional story is it was, you know, built under the timeline of one of the High Incas in the 1400s. And that's turning out to not be true. Machu Picchu is at least 10,000 years old.
Wow.
At least the core. You know, again, this is, you know, this is my absolute fascination, and the or one of them, and the tours that I give, that's why my company's called Hidden Inca Tours, is that I show people, you know, the Inca construction, which is right next to something which is 10,000 years old, which is very close to something that could be 20,000 years old. But the core of Machu Picchu, and especially the very famous Intihuatana, which is the hitching post, that is at least 20,000 years old. What happened was a culture came and built, you know, built structures there. It was abandoned. Another culture came possibly 10,000 years later, built and abandoned it, and then the Inca built 90% of what you see. But it's a very old place, and it is one of two so-called lost cities. The other one is called Choqquequirau. And it was found about, I believe, about 100 years ago. And it's about the same size as Machu Picchu, but Machu Picchu is, you know, actually overemphasized.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Where people catch the train to go to Machu Picchu is a town called Ollantaytambo. And the Ancient Aliens series that I am on, the episode that we did about Ollantaytambo was on about a week ago. Ollantaytambo is a huge site. It covers a time span, again, of more than 10,000 years. There's evidence of a major catastrophe happening there that demolished a huge megalithic building. There's also on the side of the adjacent mountain that most of the guides won't show you is the face, a human face carved into the stone that's 500 feet tall.
Wow.
And most people don't see it. And I, you know, I'm sorry, but I find it comical when I go there, you know, with people. And the guides point out one thing, point out something else. And these people are literally looking at this. But unless you specifically point it out to someone, they won't see it. Mm. But once you see it, you can't unsee it. But the entire Sacred Valley and above Cusco, there are so many ancient small places which are fascinating. But the majority of people visit Cusco for a day, Machu Picchu for a day, and then leave. And it's very, you know, it's too bad because you could easily spend a week there.
Yeah. There's so much more to see.
Oh, yeah. No, it goes on forever.
Everywhere you walk, there just seems to be just ruins everywhere, doesn't there?
Yeah, well, actually, that's the fun thing is that Jesus Gamara, who's a... who is an expert. He's not very well known outside Cusco, but he's one of the masters when it comes to the knowledge of the Inca culture, the one that came before possibly 10,000 years ago and the one that was, you know, possibly 20,000 years ago. We went to this one small site above Cusco, you know, where it looks like stone has been somehow cut, you know, like these cubes the size of refrigerators have been removed from the mountainside with perfect accuracy. Mm. And there are many of those. And so, you know, he showed me, I think, three that day, and I said, it's amazing. How many more are there? And he said, between here and the Sacred Valley, there are 5,000 more.
Wow.
So it's
one of them's called Sexy Woman, but that's the English version of it. So it's Sexy Woman or something.
Yeah, the conventional name is Sacsayhuaman. The true name seems to be Sacsayhuaman, which means the furrowed head of the puma. But it has the largest megalithic stone blocks in South America. The largest are, I think, about 120 tons, and they fit together. They fit together perfectly.
Yeah, that was amazing.
So is it kind of, when you say a megalithic site, what is it? Are they standing stones or a circle or a combination?
Actually, all the above. The major places such as Ollantaytambo and Sacsayhuaman and Amarumacha, there are many of them. But those two are the most famous. Pizoc is another one. But that is where you find these, you know, giant stones of, you know, say 40 tons. You know, unfortunately, you know, I, being of a scientific background, I like to quote actual numbers.
Right. That's right.
No, because, some people say it was 400 tons, and you're saying, prove it to me.
Right, yeah.
And it's like, no, you know, in terms of realistic estimates, 40 tons, 60 tons. The largest I've seen is 120 tons, but that's, you know, the weight of 60 or 80 automobiles.
Yeah.
And these, they interlock in a, not perfect, but so close that you can't fit a piece of paper in between them. Mm-hmm. And the other amazing thing that most people don't know about Sacsayhuaman or Sacsayhuaman, the giant wall that's there, it isn't just that the original builders were able to take these giant blocks and interlock them, but they're also pictograms. They're like jigsaw puzzles composed of animal figures. So
really?
Not only were the built... Oh, yeah. The first time that was shown to me, was it's like, what? He said, yeah, that's a llama. And it's like, oh my God, you know, and there's a snake and there's a condor, and you're going, who were these people? this is nuts, you know. Not only
very
did they
spiritual.
Oh, very, but not only did they integrate these stones in an amazing manner, but they decided to make patterns out of them as well.
Mm. And are you saying patterns of the pictographs or of the stones? Or both?
Well, I mean putting the stones together in a jigsaw shape so that they make representations of full animals.
Oh,
wow. Fish, like fish and llama, snakes, condor, you know, different animals in different places. And there's obviously there's a spiritual symbolic purpose for the exact placement of each one, but that's something right. that, you know, I still hopefully have 40 or 50 years to, you know, to live and research right. the rest of it, because yeah. every day's an adventure here. I'm just, you know, my mind is constantly blown by, you know, what I'm exposed to. I'm very blessed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it sounds wonderful. It really is. You are very blessed. I wish I was there by your side to enjoy seeing some of this.
Anytime you want to, please come down.
Oh, I will. I will. You got me thinking, though, when you're talking about the different lines and the different pictures, I can't help but think of the lines. What are they called? The Nazca lines. Have you seen any of those, or is that by you? I'm not even quite sure where they're placed down there.
Yeah, actually, Nazca is just east of here, southeast. And again, thanks to the Ancient Alien series, we were filming here in Paracas, and we went to Nazca and Cusco.
Oh, great.
So I was able to meet.
Sorry. They're going to be doing an episode with the Nazca lines as well?
Yeah, Nazca is, as far as I know, Nazca is on Thursday night.
Wonderful, wonderful. We're gonna talk more about Ancient Aliens and what you guys talked about, but I don't want you to give away too much as far as the episode is concerned. But what can you tell us about the Nazca lines? Have you been able to go there yourself? Well, of course you went there, but where, how, and why for those lines? But have we really come up with any idea of how they were created and how were they able to construct such wonderful pictographs that were seen from so far away?
Yeah, they're actually not that complex, and I did make a Nazca line when we were filming. We actually walked out across the landscape a little bit, and I showed how it was done. It's quite simple. The surface layer is oxidized because of this, you know, the intense sun. So any of the stone that has any kind of iron or mainly iron content, it'll oxidize over time, and that, you know, that's rust more or less. So the surface is grayish brown, but if you scratch under the surface, there's a clay deposit underneath which is white, and it's the contrast between those two that produces the effect. What I was able to find out by meeting an archaeologist there who is doing groundbreaking research, you know, quote unquote, is that the animal figures were not made by the same culture as the lines. The animal figures were made by the Paracas people, who lived as far east and south as Nazca. It was the later Nazca culture that made the line system over top of the animal figures.
Oh, wow. So it's almost a layered effect, layered effect of cultures adding, I guess.
Exactly. Well, one great example is if you look at a picture of the famous spider one, you notice that there are lines running, you know, it's a beautiful design, and then there are these straight lines running right through it. And what I think happened is that because you can't see the animals from the ground, these people made the lines right over top of them without knowing that those were even there.
Wow.
Oh.
I love it. Now, have we figured out, is it, for lack of a better term, a sigil in honor of a spirit? I mean, like each animal, have we looked into the anthropological aspect of each particular image?
Well, with the animals, if they were done by the Paracas culture, you know, the unfortunate thing is since so little research has ever been done on them, you know, like I was saying, not much since 1928, I guess it's, you know, to some degree it's up to me and others to find out more and more about them. The very curious thing about the animal figures is that where they, you know, where the line starts to trace the outline, that line never comes back to meet the original source point, which is really kind of odd. So we don't really know what, you know, why they were made. The lines themselves were probably more pragmatic. Because Nazca is so desert-like, all of the water there comes underground from the Andes. Major, you know, subterranean water systems. And so I think that a lot of the lines are simply plot lines that the people made in order to keep a record of where the aqueduct, you know, the underground aqueducts travel so that in times of harshness they could tap into them to access water. You know, the idea that they were there for aliens to land is,
right,
is just corny because, you know, a highly evolved intergalactic civilization would, you know, would have anti-gravity, so they would be moving up and, you know, vertically. They wouldn't have to have landing strips.
Exactly. And thank you so much for being so blunt about that, because that is lot. It makes logical sense by all means.
Mm.
It's nice to know that there are cultures that this culture was smart enough to do something like that and apply it to where it could benefit the rest of the culture.
Exactly. Well, it's just, you know, whenever mysteries come up here, at least, I like to look at the people first, at the ancestral people, and try to figure out if they made them, and if so, you know, how and why. And then, you know, if that's impossible, then I would go into the alien hypothesis.
Right.
But I think too many people immediately jump into the alien thing without giving due respect to the fact that our ancestors collectively were incredibly intelligent people. Yeah. We've been lied about. You know, this whole historical thing we've been given is this lie about, you know, civilization only developed in Egypt, and then it became Greece, and then it became Rome, and
right,
all the rest of the world was barbaric. And it's like, I don't think so. You know, I walk past things almost, you know, like especially in Cusco, you see things which our technology could barely touch now. The proof that the Inca didn't do the megaliths is that the only tools they had were bronze chisels and stone hammers. And the same is the case in Egypt. The building of the pyramids, it would be impossible with those tools because the Great Pyramid, for example, as Chris Dunn would say, is designed like a machine. It was meant to function as a machine to produce electricity for some reason. But what I love about Chris is that being an engineer, if you ask him, when was it done, he'll say, I'm an engineer, I can't tell you. Or if you say, Chris, who do you think made it? He'll say, I'm an engineer. I will not go there. So, you know, I'm thankful because too many people automatically say, my theory is, and often they don't have any information to back it up. That's why, you know, the historical people in the alternative field who seem to know a little about everything, I really don't trust them too much. You know, I like people who say, that's for Graham Hancock to answer, or that's for Stephen Naylor to answer. You know, I don't know. I love saying to people, I have no idea.
Yes.
This, everything that I've learned today during the show, when you said about people calling society way back then barbaric, I would just like to add that it seems that our society today seems far more barbaric than it may have been back then, because when you think about it, they seem to have everything right back then, and all they have to do is do a little research into this, and you figure out that everything that we do today seems so wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you know what? That makes sense, Trevor, because the way, at least this is what I'm getting from what you're saying, they seem to have locked into the natural forces of the earth, the natural energies of, I don't know, spirituality, energy, whatever, versus, you know, they didn't need petroleum, you know, as much as we do. So that I can relate, I can agree with what you're saying there, absolutely. We're definitely overdue for a break. We need to take a very short break. We're going to take a two-minute break, but when we come back, I would like to talk to Brian a little bit more about, the Ancient Alien series, which are they still filming down there, Brian?
I'm hoping that they're going to come back, because I found places for them to film that no one, as far as I can tell, no one has filmed before.
Oh, good.
And the thing is, Ancient Aliens, you know, they've covered all the major stuff in the world. So they want things that are, you know, that are a little farther afield. And I found two for them which are completely mind-boggling things that are like, how was this done? The one thing is this channel carved in bedrock that goes for 10 miles in a straight line. And it's like, you know, of course, you know, wow. The story is, well, the Inca made that. And it's like, no, they couldn't have done it. Who was here? And another one is this massive stone that's in Bolivia that's all carved with, you know, it's just bizarre. So, I'm hoping they'll let me come back for that.
Cool. Well, we're going to take a short break, and hopefully when we come back, you can tell us a little bit more about these mind-blowing sites. I mean, you are a walking encyclopedia in my book, so thank you very, very much for joining us today, and I can't wait. We'll come back in 2 minutes, and we'll continue this wonderful discussion with Brian Forrester. This is Dr. Bernard Alvarez here on GIC Radio. I'm going to play just a short I was hoping that I did get to actually watch, I think it was last week. You posted it on Facebook, and I was able to watch it. I found it very, very fascinating, as I do with all of your work. But first of all, what was it like working with them? Are they are they allowing you to kind of share all the stuff that's not mainstream? I guess that's my first question.
Oh, yeah. No, the crew were great. It was a crew of 4 people from Los Angeles who came down. My wife and I coordinated, you know, all of our movements, and that's how I was originally contacted. And then they just decided to put me on camera, and then it's like, oh, okay. Oh, Brian, we have a question. Turn on the camera. So I'm on actually quite a lot, thankfully. You know, I'm very thankful that I went to acting school when I was a kid. So, it was a great experience because they wanted to see the, you know, the least conventional things that I could show them. And, we had a great, you know, I very much missed them after a week when they left because it was such a lot of fun to be with them.
Oh, that's nice. That's good. That's nice because, you know, we hear so much about, we just see so much of, like, the alternative community doing mainstream stuff. Well, no, I won't call Ancient Aliens mainstream, but bigger stuff, and they always have to censor a little bit. But I'm glad to hear that they were so accommodating, and I'm sure you were as well. What was some of the what was the most surprising thing to them as far as, like, any of the sites that you took them to that kind of, like, blew them away?
Well, they were quite, they were quite excited and shocked when I was able to show them, you know, the structures in Cusco, for example, that, were at least 10,000 years old. And also Nazca, they were amazed at how simple it was to make the lines. They were impressed with everything. The skulls was what really caught their attention more than anything, as far as I can tell. That's the show that, as far as I know, will be on this coming this Thursday. I think it's called Lost Worlds. You know, they tend to give me a title, and then just before it's to be aired, then, you know, sometimes the title changes. But I think that's what this one's about, and it relates to as well to the possible migration of people from South America to Easter Island and beyond.
And what channel is that on?
It's on the History Channel.
That's it, yeah.
And it's also sometimes available afterwards on YouTube as well. You have to kind of, you know, search for it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I that's basically how I find it, because I don't have cable television by choice. But there's always a way to find it, and I've been lucky enough to find it so far. What's the premise in reference to Lost Worlds, or at least this particular episode that they're talking about for this week? What is their premise in the sense of the message that they're trying to get across that you kind of hopefully help them out with a little bit? Is it that there's a missing culture that nobody talks about, or missing technology?
It's more the, at least I hope. Oh, here comes, actually, it's funny, that's the mayor honking his horn. He's driving in. But he, as far as I know, the episode, or the part of the episode that I'll be dealing with is the connection between Cusco, like ancient Cusco, the coast of Peru, and Easter Island as being places that were quite probably inhabited by the same people in, you know, ancient antiquity.
Oh, really?
Have you
been doing some work on Easter Island recently, or are you interested in it?
Oh, very much so. When I was living in Hawaii, I was fortunate to meet a member of the royal family from Easter Island. And, you know, she invited me to go. I haven't gone yet. That's the next trip that my wife and I plan to do. But the thing is that we've been able to trace the characteristic of red hair to Easter Island. So that, as well as New Zealand, the ancient Maori, or the Maoris talk about, an aspect of their, genetic, ancestry that comes from elsewhere of these people with red hair. It also shows up in ancient Hawaii, too. So it's possible that there was a Pacific-wide culture connecting the Pacific Ocean in general with South America.
Mm.
Oh, wow. That makes complete sense to someone who will think out of the box. Brian, as far as the elongated skulls, let's come back a little bit to the elongated skulls.
Okay.
You've been finding, how many have been found so far? Or do you know an approximate number, maybe?
I don't know. At the museum here, we have 20 now.
Wow.
The museum at ICA, which has the, you know, the four giant ones on display, I was able to get into the back storeroom, which was fun. I just asked one of the people who works there, it's like, are there more? And he said no, and then 5 minutes later he opened a door and just quietly said, you know, come in. And so I went in, and there are about 50 of them in boxes there. The museums in Lima probably have several hundred, but there are only two or three on display. Private collections have them in the United States and Europe, and probably elsewhere as well. There are hundreds of them, and there are probably hundreds of them still in the ground here.
Yeah, I would think. And you just posted a video today about one of your discoveries. Can you tell us a little bit more in detail of what you found?
Well, that was very amazing, and also, I guess you would say, heart-wrenching as well, because, you know, I approach this as a human looking at the history of humanity and not as a, you know, not as a cold, you know, science kind of thing.
Yeah.
So especially whenever we deal with skulls or anything directly relating to a person, you know, they are regarded by me as being an ancestor. So yesterday we just heard that this man who is a huaquero, which is a, you know, basically a grave robber, had found a skull. And so it's more or less our mission to, if we can, you know, if we do have the funding, is to be able to acquire these skulls so that they don't wind up on the black market, which they usually do. They're usually shuttled out of Peru and into private collections, you know, very quietly.
Yeah.
So he took us, you know, in the middle of nowhere to this tent, and we went inside, and he unwrapped this bundle, and in the bundle there was the elongated skull of a woman who was probably about 20, who had wavy reddish hair.
Wow.
And
And the little bundle next to excuse me. The little bundle next was a baby.
You could tell the atmosphere when you're watching the video how difficult it was.
Yeah, the baby was about a month old and has an elongated skull. So the thing is that, you know, I'm starting to debate, as well as I've already contacted Lloyd Pye, and he said, you know, oh my God, you know, that's a major, you know, because finding a baby skull like that is incredibly rare. I don't know,
yeah.
You know, I don't know of another one. But, you know, then the question is, what do you do? Senior Juan of the museum asked me, he said, do you think we should acquire one? And I said, no, both.
Yeah.
It's mother and baby.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we did, and so Senior Juan has them in a special special place now to basically air them out, because, you know, they've only been out of the ground for a very short period of time, and, you know, they are human. They are actually not skulls, they're mummies, and so, you know, there is the tissue aspect, so we have to make sure that they dry properly, you know, to keep them intact and make sure that, you know, that they don't decompose, and then we're going to find the right way to display them. My first thought was to rebury them, but we have no idea where they came from.
Mm.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now, with them, well, you touched on the fact that that the baby was only a month, you said about a month old.
Yeah.
So this is, I guess, logic would dictate that it was born with an elongated skull, not created. Is that one of the points?
Oh, that's the thing, but, you know, this morning when Senior Juan came to the museum, I asked about the skulls, because this, you know, happened yesterday, and he said, well, they're, you know, I have them, it'll take 30 days for them to be left untouched. So, there's, you know, they're still bound,
right.
They're still wrapped up. And then I guess he will decide the best way to display them, whether we should unwrap, you know, take the wrapping off or what. It's really up to him. To decide that, but you know, just from seeing the outline, the baby looks just like the mother, so it hints at the idea that there is at least a genetic component involved.
What I found fascinating was the hair on the mum.
I
never knew that it looked like that. It's just bizarre.
Well, it's amazing, because all of the skulls that we found that have hair, and you know, there are some, the hair is always cut short, so clearly they wanted, you know, the skull, or they wanted their head shape to be looked at.
Mm.
So if they had longer hair, then, you know, you wouldn't be able to see the outline as well. So they had short hair to show that they were, you know, the people of highest status.
Wow.
When you say higher status, I heard earlier when we were talking about, for lack of a better term, the hierarchy of the culture, there was a separate priestly class. Now, was it strictly the priestly class that has the elongated skull that we're seeing?
Yeah, it's strictly the priestly and ruling class. And like I think I was saying earlier, that probably would have been the same family. The thing is, another great thing about the Inca is that from seeing how their culture functioned, and because they learned from every other culture that came before them, you know, they're very smart that way. They took the best of everything. A lot of their spiritual system is based on civilizations that go back at least 5,000 years. So, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought again on that.
That's okay.
It's all them people behind you.
So I guess I don't know how to make this sound too much like a conspiracy theory or a little bit too out there, but, you know, we have so many in the alternative community that talk about, like, oh, I guess, like the Anunnaki or something like that, and how they came and ruled and then left and whatnot. And I just can't help but question, was their ruling class, if they were otherworldly, were they, you know, extraterrestrial that came and subjugated the people of the culture? So it's just something that spins through my head when I hear something of a ruling class and having different genetic compounds, as we see here in the United States, in the United States, but in the royal families and whatnot, that they really didn't breed outside because they wanted to keep their blood pure. So I guess, you can't help but wonder how much of these conspiracy theories are on or right or correct versus what we're finding today in the alternative research and the alternative archaeological circles. Is it fair to say that the Inca were kind to their people as far as the ruling class and their society, or was there a very big oligarchical component going on?
Well, that's an excellent question, because that's any visitor to Cusco in general will hear the story of the mighty Inca, dominating and conquering everybody, and they built an empire. But the deeper you go into it, especially the work or the writings by the one half Inca, half Spanish writer called Garcilaso de la Vega. His mother was full-blooded royal Inca, and so the deeper you go, the story seems to be that the intelligence and the way that the Inca were able to create and expand this confederation was by invitation. They invited the adjoining rulers of places to join the confederation. It's only that if they refused, then they were conquered. But it was always an invitation first. And so the highest of the Inca, the ruling high Inca, was the caretaker of the people. And you still see that today in Native American communities in the Americas. Someone who is a chief, and I know some chiefs, their role is not this like high, wearing a crown and saying, I will mate with these women and you will, I subjugate you and the gold is mine. The role of the chief is the caretaker of all the needs of all the people. And that seems to be what the Inca were. They were the caretakers. They were so, they were so organized and intelligent that, they probably would have thought it stupid for someone not to want to join them, because they had, the road system, they had mathematics, they had astronomy, they had the high art, they had, anything you can name in a evolved civilization is what the Inca were, as being very distinct from a lot of the people that they absorbed, because they weren't as, their agriculture wasn't as good, their metallurgy wasn't as good, their road systems weren't good, but the Inca, as soon as they would absorb, they would improve the road system, the agriculture, the irrigation, and the three basic principles that guided the Inca were: everybody has a job, everybody has food, and everybody has a house.
That's nice.
It sounds like a good foundation for any society.
Yeah, except of course for people who were old or infirm, they were housed, they were fed, and they were given things to do. So it was, it was a so-called socialist system, which I would call a human-based system.
Yeah.
It was, the so-called rulers were the caretakers of the people, as compared to what we think of as, medieval Europe, where it's like, I'm king so-and-so, I shall smite thee and take everything I want.
And, that... Excuse me. That brings a thought to mind. Was this Inca civilization patriarchal based, or was it more matrifocal?
That's an excellent question. The thing is, the highest of the Inca was always male. I'm not sure because the founder or the first Inca, Manco Capac, was male, but his wife was also his sister. I mean, the Inca were, I wouldn't say obsessed, but the Inca were a family. The only people you can call Inca were the ruling family. You can't call the Peruvians Incas. It was a specific ruling family. They only married within themselves, and the ruling Inca always married his eldest sister. But the term sister could mean cousin. You know,
yeah.
we can't use the exact
term. Literal.
Exactly, but they always only intermarried or only married with each other, mm-hmm. and that was maintained until the Civil War. And that was the problem with the Civil War. You had the firstborn Inca who was supposed to, you know, take over from his father and take care of everything. But the last of the Inca, called Huayna Capac, decided to divide, and that was a stupid, I have to say it was a stupid mistake, because he gave his half-blooded son part and the other son the rest. And of course, when you have two brothers mm-hmm. and you have property, you're going to have squabbling, and their their battle is what allowed the Spanish to easily come in and take over. And just one final little point on that is the fact that the Inca had rules of warfare, like a lot of cultures have. You know, you're allowed to fight this way, but you can't fight that way. Like, you can't fight dirty.
Right.
But what the Spanish did is that they lied continually, and so when they when they were at war with the Inca, they would, they would do things, barbaric things that the Inca were, in honesty, shocked. It's like, you're not allowed to fight like this. And it's like the Spanish mm-hmm. say, we can do whatever we want, So that was another thing that, when the conflict between the two happened, the Inca believed that there would be rules of play or rules mm-hmm. of warfare. And the Spanish just said, no way, We have come for one thing. We've come for the gold.
Yeah.
Because Pizarro and every one of the conquistadors was desperately in debt. So it was either, they either had to plunder, or the alternative was they would be sent back to Spain and be thrown in jail. So that's why they became ruthless.
Mm. I might have another discrepancy for you.
Okay.
I got told by a guide that I can't say Ollantaytambo properly. What is it?
Oh, Ollantaytambo.
That's the one, yes. That the last battle where the Incas actually fell and was there.
Actually, that is true. The thing is that after the Spanish took over Cusco, they tried to set up a puppet Inca government. And the, they basically said, well, you're the oldest of the Inca, so therefore you're going to be the king. That way they would have a puppet to put in front of the people and mm-hmm. say, you still have your Inca family, you still have your ruler, but, that was Manco Inca, and he caught on pretty fast that he was going to have no power to do anything. So he rebelled. And the rebellion continued for about 200 years. They had to retreat from Cusco, first to Ollantaytambo, where there was a major battle, and then they moved farther and farther back into the jungle. And it was only through the deceit by the Spanish that the final Inca ruler was captured and I believe beheaded.
Wow.
And that destroyed them.
I was going to say, it kind of sounds like the way the United States Empire works, installing puppet leaders, but that's another show.
Yeah, exactly what I was thinking.
Well, it's a time-proven, time-proven technique.
Absolutely. It sure seems to be.
Yeah.
My goodness. Brian, we touched on Machu Picchu a little bit, and I personally have never been there. I know Yvonne has been there, and yes, it is the most popular, site of the Incan people. And you had mentioned how the Inca basically moved in. Am I incorrect? Was Machu Picchu there before the Inca?
Yeah, actually, if you read, even if you read Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock, he has a quote in there. There were, I believe, German archaeologists who early in the last century, I believe, or mid-century maybe, they used archaeoastronomy, which is becoming a much more popular way to date structures. It's based on the position of a building relative to its position to, or its relationship to the cardinal directions.
Mm.
And because the planet has a slight wobble to its orbit that takes place over 26,000 years, exact alignments tend to go out of whack a little bit before they come back. And so Machu Picchu, by these two archaeologists, was dated at least 3,000 to 5,000 years old. But their information was immediately hushed, and their careers were trashed as a result of that. The work of Arthur Snatsky is even more interesting because he dated Tiwanaku, again based on archaeoastronomy, at, I believe, you know, different people give different numbers, but I believe 15,000 years ago.
Wow, that's quite a long time.
Yeah, so with Machu Picchu, though, it seems to me, from working with Jesus Gamarra and other people, that the Intihuatana, which again is the hitching post of the sun, is of the oldest, and it could very well be 20,000 years old. And then there are secondary, beautiful, you know, the beautiful buildings, small ones that are there, which are perfect. They're probably in the order of about 10,000 years old.
Wow. Now, as far as the function of Machu Picchu, we hear so many different stories as far as how it was used. It was whether it was used for ceremonial or whether it was an actual thriving village. I've heard things that each of the terraces were different gardens. What can you tell us as far as the actual function of what you've learned of Machu Picchu?
Well, I think the smartest idea is that the best analogy is Camp David in the United States.
Oh, okay. You know,
Camp David is where the president goes when he wants to meet with, foreign officials and his people to get away from the public eye. And that seems to be the function of Machu Picchu. The climate is better, a little bit better than, Cusco, because it's at lower elevation. There's the famous Inca Trail that takes you there. It's very in ancient times it would have been very difficult to get at because there are only two accesses to it. And so it seems to have performed this function during the Inca period, that's where the high Inca would go in order to meet the heads of the different parts of the Inca Confederation in order to be able to consult with them, because, the Inca Confederation went from Colombia in the north all the way down to the middle of what is Chile, which is a huge distance when you don't have automobiles. And so in order to get the representatives from the southern point, to give you a basic story of what's going on in that part of the world, or your want to consult with them for probably an extended period of time, so Machu Picchu was perfect for that. It was only for the royal, the higher echelons of the culture to be there. But it all the terracing system, which is marvelous there, meant that it was self-contained. So they could cut, they could put barriers up at the two entrances and say nobody comes in. We have the water system still works.
Wow.
So they'd have lots of water and food, and they'd be able to consult with each other and do that sort of thing without the prying eyes or ears of anyone.
Wow. And when you're saying I don't want to say the empire, the confederation, extended all the way into Colombia, were the Mamas involved with that, or is that a later culture?
No, that's farther north.
Okay.
Yeah, the thing is that what happened with the Inca, that's one of the latest books I just wrote is about that. It's a timeline of the origin of Cusco to the time when when the Spanish arrived. I didn't bother covering the Spanish because I've already done that part.
Right.
But basically, the basic story is once they had reached their apex, to the west they were stuck because of the Pacific Ocean. To the east, they couldn't penetrate the Amazon too much because the native people there didn't want anything to do with the Inca, and the native people there were very experienced at jungle warfare. So they could be up in trees with bows and arrows and just, pick the Inca soldiers off. So the Inca decided after a certain period to say, well, that's it. We can't go farther into the Amazon. We'll trade with them, but we can't either conquer or absorb their lands. To the north, they encountered more and more barbaric people the farther they went, people who were involved with, human cannibalism,
right,
and all sort. And so the Incas just sort of went, okay, well, I don't think we want these people as part of our community.
Right, right.
We'll send them back away. And then to the south, the trouble was, the distance between the middle of Chile and Cusco is an incredible distance. They also didn't find much there that they really wanted in terms of resources. So they did have a battle there, but after that they thought, well, you know, there's nothing really here that captures our attention too much. So let's just put up a border and say that's it. So that's, you know, that's how the borders of the Inca Confederation ended.
Oh, I get it. Now I get it. you mentioned earlier about astroarchaeology, and I found that very fascinating. In the research and the work that you've discovered over the years, I'm sure there are sites and whatnot that are aligned astronomically and whatnot. Now, being that there is sites that are astronomically aligned, maybe to cardinal points or to specific star clusters or whatnot, is there anything to, and this is going into the Ancient Aliens topic, is there anything to perhaps say that they were trying to communicate with otherworldly beings, or maybe create a symbol like we thought the Nazca lines were?
That's a good question. I love the topic. I'm not a staunch Ancient Aliens fan necessarily, but
right.
My part of my genetic character may come from somewhere else. I've actually, years ago, I did a fair bit of work on studying the Pleiades star system, because that seems to be where the most, human looking aliens would have come from.
Mm-hmm.
And their ancestors supposedly came from the Lyra system. It's this recurrence of the Pleiades, which is intriguing. The Hawaiians talk about ancestry coming from the Pleiades. Their name for the Pleiades is Makali'i, which means little eyes in heaven.
Oh, wow.
And then you find that in Indonesia, you find that among, actually, what's it called? Devil's Tower, Wyoming. The native people of there have the same story. It's also this recurring theme, which you find all over the world, where seven sisters came down, and six sisters returned. One sister stayed, and she became the ancestor of either humanity or branches of humanity.
Yeah.
So that I found intriguing. I've been talking recently with Stephen Mailer. Of course, everyone now knows that the Sphinx, for example, is aligned perfectly to the rising of Leo.
Yeah.
And so in terms of archaeoastronomy, or the aspect called the precession of equinox, Leo rose where the Sphinx is pointing 12,000 years ago. And I believe John Anthony West was the one who was the first to find that. He's the one who brought Dr. Robert Schock to Egypt and said, you're a geologist. This Sphinx thing looks pretty ancient. Can you tell us what the erosion was caused from? And Dr. Schock, who's a geologist, said water did that. It couldn't have been airborne sand.
Right.
So, well, of course, what they figured out is that 12,000 years ago, the environment in Egypt was much wetter. There was a lot of rain. So that kind of dates the, dates the Sphinx at 12,000 BC. It's a lion head looking at a lion 12,000 years ago. In Peru, there hasn't, that's something else I hope to get into. There hasn't been too much. The Inca had this obsession with the Pleiades again, and I, in terms of it being a cluster of stars, it's just this, little cluster of stars. It's not this great constellation. So I tend to think there is something, something to the ancient connection with, possible ancestral people from the Pleiades, or so-called in that direction, seeding Earth in the distant past.
Yeah. Wonderful. And we're going to find a lot more I guess we'll learn more about what you've discovered on Ancient Aliens. And I look forward to that. That's going to be on Thursday, you said?
Yeah.
Cool. Very cool. Now, your website is called HiddenIncaTours.com. Is that correct?
Yeah, www.HiddenIncaTours.com. And the other website that I have now, which is more for Paracas, is www.visitparacas.com.
Nice. You're going to be, I guess you're going to be doing a tour. We have an advertisement on our website for an ancient, let me look at it correctly and say it correctly. It is, All of a sudden, my internet slowed up. Sorry about that. Ancient Peru, and you're going to be doing a tour from November 10th through the 20th. And if I'm not mistaken, you're going to have Hugh Newman with you as well. What's this tour going to be like? What are people going to get to see? What are they going to experience? Can you tell us a little bit more about that? And it's going to be on 11/11 as well. That looks wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that looks really great. Tell us a little bit about the Megalithomania tour.
Sure. No, it's great because we have David Hatcher Childress going to be with us too. I got to stay with David at his house a couple of months ago, and he and I get along really well. He and I are co-authoring this Elongated Skull book, as well as, you know, we'll do a DVD. As far as I can tell, it's the first tour that is going to cover all of the major megalithic sites, Tiwanaku in the south in Bolivia to Cusco, including Machu Picchu, covering the Inca period, the older culture of 10,000 years before, and the culture before that of 20,000 years before. So it's going to be, Hugh and David and I discussing, with our guests, and showing them exactly what the Inca made and, describing how they could have done it, and then the other structures which clearly they could not have done. And the great thing is that there are many sites, especially around Cusco, where, in a very, you can see all three forms of construction in the exact same building. So I'm very excited about that. David's been, stating for years that the Inca couldn't have built some of these things, and I totally back him up. And the information is building, and the knowledge is building to prove our point. And I do it, I do it out of respect for the Inca, because I want the Inca to be known for what they did, but I don't want them to be blown up to be these superhumans who did impossible things, but describe what they did, and then give justice to the history of Peru, and that, there have been evolved people living here for many thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned, you just had me spin my head for a second, you mentioned that there was a culture before the Incas and then a culture before the culture that was before the Incas. That goes back, you said 20,000 years. Have we named this culture yet, or we just calling them Ancient Inca, or...
Oh, no, actually, I defer to Jesus Gamarra to name them. His father did. And his father, who died, I think more or less in obscurity, he came up with the concept after like 40 years of living in Cusco and studying it. They call the earlier culture Uranpacha. And they call the culture before that Hananpacha. And the Inca are called Ukunpacha. And what that relates to is it relates to the three levels of consciousness and the three levels of spirituality. Because the Hananpacha is the subconscious. Or no, sorry, I've got this backwards. No, but basically what Jesus is trying to say is that the Hananpacha, who were the oldest, were actually the most highly evolved people.
Mm.
The Uranpacha came later, and they were highly evolved people, and technically highly evolved as well. And then the Inca came; they were very sophisticated, humanitarian people, but technically they weren't that swift. So it's a question of a timeline of the disappearance of technology, but quite probably the maintenance of a humanistic philosophy that the Inca were the last representatives of.
Wow, and you've given me a pattern, a thought pattern in my mind now, because I can't help but notice that when we're talking about older cultures, it seems like the older and further we go back, the more evolved they were, and their technology and their, I don't want to say intelligence to be rude, but I have to, seems to be dwindling as we get closer to the modern Western history, or lack of. Are you finding the same thing, that it seems like the older and older and older, even the Egyptians is a good example, that the technology seems to dwindle as we come closer to modern time? Is this a continuing thread throughout the cultures around the world, or at least in Peru, that you're finding?
Oh, definitely. No, that's a great point, because according to Stephen Mailer again, with the ancient, they're called Kemetians, the people of Egypt who were there prior to the pharaohs. Kemet is supposedly was the name of Egypt early on, which means the black land. Black meaning the soil was black, so it's fertile. But what seems to be surfacing is the fact that these ancient cultures were, it's kind of corny to say they were lived in harmony with nature, but they understood the physical laws so well that they didn't necessarily have to build machines that had moving parts. They were able to use nature is what we do, but they were able to utilize the natural forces for their own, for their own benefit. For example, supposedly there is a huge system of tunnels under the sand in Egypt where the Great Pyramids are. And according to Stephen, the Nile used to be, I believe, to the west of where it is. And whoever these ancient people were, they tapped into that water source, and they had this ancient system of subterranean aqueducts running underneath the pyramids. And that water, passively, or not passively, but moving of its own accord, was right, what fueled the power plants. And they were supposedly, plants that produced hydrogen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were hydrogen. As far as I know, Chris right. Dunn is the expert, not me. I read his stuff and often screw up what he says. But supposedly that's how it worked. Like, there weren't really machine parts moving inside the pyramid, but it was the movement of water that went through, and the use of the energy of the earth, and then certain attunements were made, and that's why the proportions are specific, that the water somehow entering under the Great Pyramid was able to harmonize somehow to separate into hydrogen molecules and oxygen molecules, thereby creating hydrogen, thereby creating an energy source for some kind of power,
right,
of some kind.
Yeah. In relation to your question, Bernard, Annie put it well in chat when she stated, "We have evolved backwards with the evolution of reptilian consciousness."
That's a good one. And you know what? I can't help. It brings up a point that I'd like to ask Brian, is this whole reptilian symbology or symbolism.
Yeah,
that is all. Well, it's all over the world, basically, and it seems like, everything from Judeo-Christianity on, the serpent is evil and it's the devil and whatnot. But what in relation to the Peruvian civilizations, what did the serpent represent? I mean, I can give a definition as far as what it means in the tarot cards, but as far as these civilizations, what did the serpent represent that you've come across?
That's an excellent question, because the three symbols of the Inca spiritual system are, they knew of the three states of consciousness: subconscious, conscious, superconscious. The Hawaiians sorry, you know, because I lived in Hawaii, you know, and studied their, you know, belief systems, they had exactly the same knowledge, subconscious, mm-hmm. conscious, superconscious. So what the Inca did is they symbolized all three. The subconscious is the reptile or the snake. The conscious is the puma. The superconscious is the condor. So when you see these representations in ancient Inca and pre-Inca structures, that is what they're telling you. They're telling you that, you know, that at this place, because we use these symbols, this is what we're trying to, you know, this is what we're trying to tell you. So the serpent symbol you find all over, you know, you still find in Cusco. The Spanish did a great job of destroying snakes wherever they could find them.
Yeah, yeah.
On buildings and things. You can, you know, as part of my tours, I show people where the snakes are still carved into, you know, stone walls and things. It represented wisdom. And the Quechua name is Amaru. Which is the Quechua name for snake, but it's that's what that represents, and it's very big. But the Inca also learned that from a much older civilization. So that trilogy or that triad of knowledge of states of consciousness plus the symbolism of these animals goes back several thousand years.
And I'm sitting here and I'm looking at the chat, and it's funny how Annie's just saying, actually I think it's Heidi, is saying that in the Bible it's the villain. And it's weird how the modern controlling, during the Catholic Church and whatnot, the modern controlling would symbolize the serpent, which is, you said the subconscious. Is that right?
Yeah, that's
right. So it was subjugated as the villain, and it goes right back to what you're saying, almost what we talked about at the beginning, how the modern religion and or power structure tries to make the older one look evil and make you feel like you would be embarrassed of that. And it seems like they've done a very good job with the snake and the serpent of suppressing that as a power figure. In the East, we have the Kundalini serpent that we talk about all the time, which is also represented by the serpent. And when we talk about the esoteric, we're looking at the serpent as a symbol of regeneration and rebirth and wisdom. But it seems like the Western power structure has seemed to really try to make it sound really horrible. And we've only got about 5 minutes left, but I was wondering, and I don't know if this is off topic for you, Brian, but maybe it's not because we're talking about, we have talked about ancient aliens, but, and I'm sure maybe perhaps you've come across these theories of the reptilians, the reptilian aliens and whatnot. Are they calling them reptilian aliens in the same way that Christianity is calling it, or is it misunderstood? Is there like a certain connection there, or is that just something that you haven't looked into?
Not really. The symbol of the serpent, it's quite possible that what they were referring to is that they may have known the concept of evolution. So it may be that the serpent they knew was like a very ancient thing, and so wisdom is something which is ancient. The subconscious is something which is ancient because it goes back. So they may have used it for that reason. The puma was used because it's a mammal like we are. So it's like that's the conscious mind, because the puma walks around and looks at things and is on legs and that kind of thing. The monkeys are in the jungle, they're not around Cusco. And then the condor was used the same way that Native Americans use the eagle. The condor flies high, so it's at an ascended level, so it symbolizes the fact that it's possibly a symbol of the higher state of consciousness. It's closer to the sun, which is the source, so let's use the symbol for that. And that's also where the concept of the Inca and their relationship with the sun has to be explained a little more. You know, people say, well, they were sun worshippers. It's not really that. It's that the Inca knew that the sun represented the source of energy. and the source of life. But what they were, again, it's poetic. So what, when they say we are the sons of the sun, or sons and daughters of the sun, it means we are sons and daughters of the source. And that we use the sun as a symbol because it's physical. But the, but what it actually means is that which is infinite and that which is hidden. But we need something to symbolize a source. And so, you know, the sun comes up, it makes plants grow. So we'll use the sun. So we are the children of that. But it's the sun behind the sun, which is what we're referring to, which is the source of all things.
Wow. Thank you for that, Brian, because
we hear
so many people talk about these sun cults and whatnot, and it's taken literal. And, I've kind of understood that. It's kind of, we call it the central sun or the inner sun or the hidden sun. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly what you just described. And I think that people, unfortunately get caught up in the terminology and take it so literally that we forget that it's meant to be poetic.
Mm. Now, sorry, but you know, another important point is that in places like Cusco, they'll use the term cult over and over again.
Yeah.
This, you know, this temple was built for a water cult,
right.
Or this was built as a serpent. You know, okay, what are these cults? You know, what are you people talking about? But in order to get the tourists through the tour, a lot of people use these. You know, use terms like, it was a water cult, or, the Inca built that, or, we have to move on because now we're going here, and I just can't do that. You know, for example, when we go to Ollantaytambo, it's not a 2-hour tour, it's 8 hours, because that place is incredibly complicated. And the same with any of these places, it's like, we'll leave this site when you tell me you want to go. I'm not going to shove you on the bus because, you know, I can't disrespect the ancestors that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Heidi. I'm watching. I'm seeing what you're pointing out is that the cult, the modern cult that we're seeing in the media is very different from the actual definition. And if we were to call anybody a cult, any religion is a cult. So you can't just dilute it like that. So I'm very glad that you take the time out to explain that to the people. Tell us again, we've got to get going in another minute, but can you tell us a little bit about where people can contact you if they are interested in going on the tour in Peru in November?
Well, actually, truthfully, that tour is full.
Oh, already?
Yeah, we're at, you have to stop at some point, and it's because we have to coordinate people to move. I mean, it'd be great to say, we want 10,000 people to come on this tour, but we've decided basically, hopefully Hugh's, not going to, I don't think he'll shoot me for saying this, but, we've reached a nice number of people and, you don't want too many people because then it spoils it. Anytime people want, they can contact me through Facebook or even better through my website, www.hiddenincatours.com. It describes all the tours that I do with other people. I like to think that our tours are special because we do discuss the ancient places. We do have experts in Cusco that we can hire, on a daily basis who are oral tradition experts. I do these tours out of respect for the culture and the history. I don't do them necessarily I do make money, but it's not, I hate the term business related to it.
Right,
it's a service I do, but I do like to be compensated for it.
Of course.
So if I can put it that way. Yeah.
Absolutely. And you deserve it, especially with all of your knowledge. My goodness. Well, we're going to need to wrap things up, and I want to thank you very, very much, Brian, for this amazing, I mean, really, really thank you for this amazing, educational couple hours here.